Let's talk about Good Guy, Bad Guy, one of the best-known negotiating gambits. Charles Dickens first wrote about it in his book Great Expectations. You remember in the first chapter, Pip is lost in the fog of the marshes of England, and out from the fog comes a prisoner with chains around his legs. His negotiating problem is to get Pip to go into the village and get a file so that he can remove the chains and bring it back to him. This would require him to put enough pressure on Pip to go do it, but not put so much pressure that Pip would get so scared that he wouldn't return. And he used the good guy, bad guy technique. He said, "Pip, you know, I really like you, and I would never, ever do anything to harm you. But I have this friend out in the fog, this bad guy, and there's just no telling what he might do if you don't help me." I'm sure you've seen good guy, bad guy used in movies and television programs. When a suspect is brought into the police station for interrogation, the first detective to interrogate him is a rough, tough, mean-looking guy. He threatens the suspect with all kinds of things that they're going to do to him. He's mysteriously called away to take a phone call, and the second detective who's brought in to look after the prisoner while the first detective is away is the warmest, nicest guy in the entire world. He sits down, he makes friends with the prisoner, he gives him a cigarette, and he says, "Listen, kid, it's really not as bad as all that, and I've kind of taken a liking to you. I know the ropes around here. Why don't you let me see what I can do for you with them?" Good guy, bad guy. And it's a real temptation to think that the good guy's on your side, when of course he really isn't. Then he would go ahead and close on what your salespeople will recognize as a minor point. "All we really need to know," he says, "is where did you buy the gun? And what they really want to know is where did you hide the body?" But starting out with a minor point and then working up from it works very well, doesn't it? It's the automobile salesperson that says to you, "If you did invest in this automobile, would you get the blue or the gray? Would you want the velour or the leather seats?" Little decisions lead up to big ones. It's the real estate salesperson who says, "If you did invest in this home, where would you put the furniture in the living room? Or which of these bedrooms would be the nursery for your new baby?" Little decisions build up to big decisions. Good guy, bad guy is worked on you an awful lot more than you might believe. Look out for it anytime you're dealing with two people. Salesperson, sales manager, business partners, husband and wife. And chances are you'll see it being used on you in one form or another. For example, you might be negotiating a contract with a couple of people who are in your office. Everything appears to be going along fine. You feel you're going to accomplish all of your objectives in the negotiation, and then one of them starts getting irritated. Finally, he says to his partner, "Look, I don't think these people are interested in making a serious proposal here. I'm not going to waste any more time on this," and storms out of the room. This shakes you up if you're not used to negotiating. Then the second person sheepishly gets up, closes his briefcase, goes all the way to the door, like the J. Douglas Edwards doorknob close. But in the doorway, after you think you've lost it all, he turns around and he says, "Look, I don't think that kind of thing is fair. I still think we can work this out. If you could just be a little bit more flexible, I'm sure we can still put it together." And if you don't realize what they're doing to you, you'll hear yourself say something like, "Well, what do you think he'd go along with?" And pretty soon you'll have him negotiating for you, and he's not even on your side. Look, true confession time. Haven't we all at one time or another said to a salesperson, "What do you think you could get your sales manager to go along with?" As if the salesperson is on our side, not on theirs. So look out for it. The counter tactic to good guy, bad guy is, first of all, to just identify the tactic. It's so well known that people are embarrassed when they get caught doing it. Oh, you say, smiling, "Come on, you guys are not going to play good guy, bad guy with me, are you? Come on, sit down, let's work this thing out." And their embarrassment will cause them to retreat from the position. The second thing you could do is to go over their heads to a possible supervisor. For example, if you're dealing with a real estate salesperson, you may call their broker and say, "Look, your salespeople were playing good guy, bad guy with me. You don't approve of that kind of thing, do you?" And the third thing you can do to counter good guy, bad guy is to say to the good guy, "Look, I understand what you two are doing to me, and I want you to know from now on, anything that he says, I'm going to attribute to you also." So now you've got two bad guys to deal with, and it diffuses the tactic. This tactic is very, very effective even when everybody knows what's going on. It's what Carter and Reagan got the hostages out of Iran with, wasn't it? You remember that? Carter lost the election. He was very anxious to do something about the Iranian hostage situation before he left the White House. And he started playing good guy, bad guy with the Ayatollah. He started saying to him, look, if I were you, I'd settle this thing with me. Don't take a chance on this new team coming into office in January. My goodness, have you taken a look at these guys? The president's a former macho cowboy actor. Vice president is head of the CIA. Secretary of State is Alexander Haig. These guys are crazier than Arabs. There's no telling what they might do. And Reagan, playing along with it, said, hey, if I were you, I'd settle with Carter. He's a nice guy. You are definitely not going to like what I'll have to say about it when I get into the White House. And sure enough, we saw the hostages being released on the morning of Reagan's inauguration, a clear indication that these tactics work even when the other people know what you're doing. In actual fact, when you're negotiating with a good negotiator who understands all of these gambits, it becomes more fun. It's like playing chess with a person of equal skills rather than someone that you can easily outsmart. Good guy, bad guy. Very, very effective. Now, why should you never jump at a first offer? We talked about this initially in session one, didn't we? Anytime you say yes to the first offer, people automatically think, well, I could have done better. The second thought they have is, well, something must be wrong here. So you never, ever jump at the first offer. And the third reaction would be, here's an opportunity to nibble, to get a little bit extra that I didn't expect to ask for if they're so anxious to accept this particular offer. So you never say yes to the first offer. You see, before I understood this, I thought I was a pretty good negotiator because I always came away from the negotiations, even if I didn't get everything that I hoped to get, I still came away from it feeling that I'd done a pretty good job as a negotiator. When I understood things like this, I realized that I'd just been dealing with people who were better negotiators than me, who knew how to set it up to make me feel that I had won in the negotiations. Let me tell you a story that happened to me that clearly illustrates, even in the most extreme of circumstances, why you should never say yes too quickly. As president of the real estate company, I was approached by an owner of a magazine who wanted to sell me a half page of advertising, for which he asked $2,000. Now, I thought that was a pretty good price. It was a well-distributed magazine, it was in our field, it was exactly what we needed, and I thought $2,000 was quite reasonable. However, I wanted to practice my negotiating, so I used several of these tactics on him and finally got him down to the unbelievable price of $800. Couldn't believe that I had got him down to less than half the price that seemed fair to me. So the more I thought how much I'd got him down, the more I thought, well, if I got him down this far, I wonder how low I can get him. So I used higher authority on him. I said, well, $800 seems fair to me. I do just have to run it by my board of directors. I'll get back to you in a couple of days with the final okay. A couple of days later, I called him up, and I said, look, I'm really embarrassed about this. I took it to the board of directors. I felt sure that I could sell it to them, but they just won't go along with it. They did come back with a counterproposal, but the counterproposal is so low, I'm embarrassed to even tell you about it. He said, well, what did they suggest? I said, well, they did authorize me to go ahead at $500. I'll take it, he said right away. And I felt cheated. I felt, even though I had got him down from $2,000 to $500 just because of the way he quickly said yes to the proposal, I felt that I could have done better than that. I'm frequently asked at seminars that I conduct, wouldn't you be embarrassed if one day somebody was in the audience that was involved in a story of one of these tactics that you tell? And you know, that actually did happen to me. I was speaking to the annual convention of the California Association of Realtors, over 2,000 people meeting in San Diego, California. And I told this story of the magazine salesperson. And after I got through talking, I saw this person coming up from the back of the room, and it was this magazine salesperson. And I thought, oh, am I in for a blistering now? But you know, he came up to me and he shook my hand. He said, I want to thank you so much for telling me about that. I had no idea. Just think of the business I must have lost over the years because I didn't realize that I was doing that. So never, ever jump at the first offer. Always go through the process of negotiating to make the other person feel that they won in the negotiations. And you know, I thought this was a 100% rule until I heard about a student of mine in Southern California by the name of Tim Rush. Tim Rush manages a Coldwell Banker real estate office in Southern California. He called me and he said, Roger, I was driving down Hollywood Boulevard the other night listening to your cassette tapes in my car. Hollywood Boulevard is a very rough area of Los Angeles. I stopped at a gas station to use the restroom, he said, and as I came back out to my car, somebody stuck a gun in my ribs and said, okay, buddy, give me your wallet. Well, I had just been listening to your cassette tapes, so I said, look, here's what I'm prepared to do. I'll give you the cash, but let me keep the wallet and the credit cards. Fair enough? The guy said, buddy, you didn't listen to me, did you? Give me the wallet. Yes, sir. So there are some times when you don't negotiate, but it's almost a 100% rule. Go through the process of negotiating, however good the first offer is. This is the feel, felt, found formula. Whatever people say to you in response to your proposal, don't argue with them. Always agree with them. You see, arguing always forces people to defend their position. Agreeing with them diffuses the competitive spirit. Now, let's say that you walk into a car lot and you're interested in a Mercedes automobile. You tell the salesperson the model you'd like and he walks you over to a car and you say, this is a diesel, isn't it? I don't want a diesel. I've heard about all the problems that they have with diesels. He would not argue with you. He would not say, well, obviously you don't know very much about automobiles, because if you did, you would know that diesels do this and this and this and this, and it's clearly the best thing for you to do. Don't argue with people. A lot of us, without thinking, do that. When people object to an initial proposal, we try and argue them or persuade them out of it, and that's not the thing to do. The thing to do is to agree and then gradually turn it around with the feel, felt, found formula. The salesperson would say, hey, I understand exactly how you feel about diesels. You do? Oh, sure. Just about everybody I've ever met has felt exactly the same way as you do right now about diesels. That's feel and felt. Now let's see how the found comes in. However, he said, when we've taken a closer look at it and really examined the needs of the buyer, we have always found that it really is the best way to go. Feel, felt, found. Agree with people and then gradually turn them around. It's kind of like Sir Winston Churchill from my old country. He was a grand old man. He had one big weakness. He loved to drink. And his biggest antagonist was Lady Astor, who was in favor of prohibition in England. One day, Lady Astor came up to him and said, Winston, you are disgusting. You are drunk. Now, he was a good enough negotiator not to argue with that. He agreed, and then he turned it around. He said, Lady Astor, you're absolutely right. I am drunk. But you're ugly. And in the morning, I shall be sober. Isn't that terrible? But he knew the value of agreeing and then turning it around. It's the feel, felt, found formula. When you're negotiating with people, it's important to understand that dumb is smart and smart is dumb. You're better off not to act too sophisticated when you're dealing with people, because sophistication breeds competition. If you act a little bit dumb with people, they want to help you. You remember the old Columbo television series, The Detective in the Raincoat? How smart he was to act dumb. He did it so effectively that he even had the murderers trying to help him solve the cases. Now, you don't have to act that dumb, but there are ways that you can communicate that you're not a competitive threat to the people that you're dealing with. They might say to you, there are some ambiguities in this contract, don't you think? And you say, ambiguities. Now, wait a minute, I've heard that word before, but I'm not quite sure what it means. Would you explain it to me? They think, oh boy, what a klutz we've got here. Or you say, look, fellas, would you go over these figures for me once on a time? I know you've done it a couple of times already. I must be dumb. I'm not getting it. Would you show me how that works one more time? And instead of wanting to compete with you, they want to help you. And the worst thing you could do is say, well, I've been studying Roger Dawson's home study course on negotiating. I know all there is to know about negotiating. Immediately they would think, so you think you're a good negotiator, huh? Well, just watch me, and you've got a lot of competition that you don't have to have. It's a rule in dealing with people that the value of services always appears to diminish rapidly after those services have been performed. This is called the call girl principle. It tells you that when you're negotiating, anytime you make a concession in the negotiations, ask for a reciprocal trade-off right away. The favor that you did somebody now loses value very, very quickly. 2 hours from now, the value of services has diminished rapidly. Real estate salespeople are very familiar with the call-girl principle, because when a seller of a property has a problem with it, and the real estate salesperson offers to solve that problem for 6%, it doesn't sound like an awful lot of money. The minute they have performed the service by finding the buyer, then all of a sudden that 6% starts to sound like a tremendous amount of money. 6%, the seller is saying. For what? What did they do? All they did was put it in the multiple listing service. They did an awful lot more than that, but remember the principle. The value of services always appears to diminish rapidly after those services have been performed. For the same reason, if you work on a consulting basis, you always negotiate your fee up front, not afterwards. Plumbers know this, don't they? They know that the time to negotiate with you is before they do the work, not after. We had to plumber out to the house. He said, "Mr. Dawson, I know what the problem is. I can fix it for you. It'll cost you $50. I said, "Fine, go ahead." You know how long it took him to do the work? 5 minutes. I said, "Now, wait a minute. You're going to charge me $50 for 5 minutes' work? I'm a nationally known speaker, and I don't make that kind of money." And he said, "Well, I didn't make that kind of money either when I was a nationally known speaker." If there's one thing that I can impress upon you that would make you a 10 times better negotiator, it's this. Learn to develop walk-away power. Be prepared to walk away from the negotiations. There's a mental point that you pass when you're no longer prepared to walk away. There's a point you reach in the negotiations when you start thinking, "Well, I'm going to get this. I'm going to get the best price and the best terms I possibly can, but I'm going to nail this one down." And the minute you pass over this point, whether you're a salesperson trying to get a new contract for your company, or whether you are an investor trying to acquire something, or whether you're an employer trying to negotiate a conflict with an employee who wants to leave, the minute you pass the point when you say, "I'm not prepared to walk away from this," you lose in the negotiations. So be sure you don't pass that point. There's no such thing as a contract you have to have at any price. There's no such thing as an investment acquisition that you can't live without. There's no such thing as an employee that you can't live without either. And the minute you pass the point when you think there is, you've lost in the negotiations. At seminars, when somebody comes out to me and says, "Look, I made a mistake in negotiations. This is what happened and this is what happened." This is always a part of their problem, that they passed the point when they were prepared to walk away. Somewhere down the line, in relating the story to me, they'll say to me, "I made up my mind that I was going to get it." And that's the turning point in the negotiations when they lost. Always be prepared to walk away. Let me tell you about an instance that occurred to me that may be helpful to anybody who's in business or any salesperson. I owned a couple of condominiums in Long Beach, California. That's about 50 miles from where I live. I wasn't that familiar with the marketplace, and I was having trouble finding a good real estate agent to handle it for me. Finally, I heard about someone who seemed to be very aggressive in the way he went about business, and he seemed to be the kind of person that I would want to have representing me in the sale of this property. I called him up. I said, "I've got a couple of condominiums very close to your real estate office. I'd like you to list them for me." And his response was, "I might be prepared to represent you. When can you come to my office so that we can talk about it?" I liked that. He clearly was quite familiar with negotiating. Number one, he was prepared to walk away from the listings. He didn't take the typical real estate attitude of, "Boy, for two listings, I'll drop everything and come to you right now." He said, "I might be prepared to represent you." Secondly, he knew that you should always negotiate in your own territory. He was a lot better off if he could talk me into coming to his office than if he came to my home to discuss it. So I made an appointment for 3 or 4 days later, and I went to his office and I met with him. And in the meanwhile, he had specced out the properties. He'd prepared a couple of folders of information with the suggested selling prices. And these prices were way below what I hoped the property was going to fetch. But by this point, I developed a lot of confidence in him. And I thought, well, he does know a lot more about the territory than I do, and either I trust him or I don't, I'll go along with his proposed listing prices. And then he said to me, well, Mr. Dawson, you do understand that I won't work with anything less than a 9-month listing, don't you? And I said, now, wait a minute. 9 months when we've never worked together before? I don't think I'm prepared to take my property off the market for 9 months. And what he did was terribly right. He stood up. He closed the folders that he'd been consulting. He reached across the desk with his hand extended, and he said, well, Mr. Dawson, I guess we won't be doing business together after all. He was prepared to walk away from the listings if he couldn't get what he wanted. Now, what position did that put me in? Now I was in the position of having to negotiate with him to get him to accept the listings. Of course, he didn't know who he was dealing with. If he'd have known that I was one of the country's best-known negotiators, he would have known better than to try that on me, because I was able to get him all the way down to 6 months on those listings, which is what he wanted in the first place, of course, and I admired that. We'll teach you in a minute how you always ask for more than you expect to get, so you set up a climate where the other person can win in the negotiations. But the key issue here is communicate to the other side that you are prepared to walk away. And what will typically happen for you is what happens when you're down in the stores in Mexico. When you're prepared to walk out of the store, they come racing back out after you. In our next session together, we'll continue with some more fascinating negotiating gambits.
This is the end of side 4. Please fast forward the tape to the end to cue up side 3 for your next listening.